Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. Today, books, specifically books about the American West. And with me in studio is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. Morning. Thanks for coming.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is a huge topic. I'm sure you both feel the same way. As I started to kind of think of it myself, I was like, we have hours worth of material that we have to condense down. So let's first start by defining the American West. Peter, you want to start?
Well, okay, the way we agreed when we first talked
there,
about this.
There was quite a discussion.
Yes, we were going to do west of the Mississippi, excluding Alaska and Hawaii.
I believe that was the decision.
And that was the deal we made. But it's still just, like the West itself, it's just the amount of literature on it is just stunning.
Oh,
and
enormous.
I mean, I've got just a hodgepodge, I admit it, of hodgepodge of books that I hope covers most of the territory.
I think we could easily spend an entire year talking about books about the American West because it is big.
The metaphor comes to life.
And it is shifting is the other interesting thing about the West. I found this really funny, well, funny to us because you don't think of Massachusetts necessarily as the West.
No.
But there
I never have actually, Jill. That's never crossed
However, there was a time when Massachusetts, in fact, was the West. And in Frederick Jackson Turner's classic book, which I had never heard of before we started, this shows you, I think the other thing I've learned from this show is how little I knew about or know about the West. Mm-hmm. And when you are living and have lived your entire life in the Northeast, you just have no idea. Even having been to Yosemite, having been to the Grand Canyon, it still boggles the mind at how much literature is out there, how much history is being written and rewritten and rewritten about what happens in the American West. You've got Hollywood, you've got the Native Americans, you've got the indigenous people, you've got cowboys, you've got the mythology of cowboys. Yeah. It's huge.
No, and the rewriting, I mean, this will never end.
It will never end.
The
That's right. One of the things that he does, Frederick Jackson Turner talks about in one of his essays in this, The Frontier in American History, is in fact Massachusetts. So let me just read a little bit about this. The first official frontier of the Massachusetts Bay. In the significance of the frontier in American history, I took for my text the following announcement of the superintendent of the census of 1890. Up to and including 1880, the country had a frontier of settlement. But at present, the unsettled area has been so broken into by isolated bodies of settlement that they can hardly be said to be a frontier line. In the discussion of its extent, the westward movement, etc., it cannot, therefore, any longer have a place in the census reports. 2 centuries prior to this announcement, in 1690, a committee of the General Court of Massachusetts recommended the court to order what shall be the frontier and to maintain a committee to settle garrisons on the frontier with 40 soldiers to each frontier town as a main guard. In the 200 years between this official attempt to locate the Massachusetts frontier line and the official announcement of the ending of the national frontier line, westward expansion was the most important single process in American history. The designation frontier town was not, however, a new one. As early as 1645, inhabitants of Concord, Sudbury, and Dedham, quote, being inland towns and but thinly peopled, end quote, were forbidden to remove without authority. In 1669, certain towns had been the subject of legislation as frontier towns, and in the period of King Philip's War, there were various enactments regarding frontier towns. Now, I would hazard to say we don't any longer think of Concord and Sudbury and Dedham as frontier towns, but that is the enormity of this topic.
Yes, it is, but you've broken the rule because you're east of the Mississippi, and that is, that's a very Western thing to do because there was way less law in the West, so you're in the spirit
so
of it for sure. Well, you know, this one of the reasons this topic is so interesting to me is I write under my pen name Spencer Quinn, the Chet and Bernie mystery series, where Chet is the dog of the Detective Bernie, and Chet tells the story even though he's not a talking dog. But most of them take place in in the West, and the desert in Arizona is almost a character in this series. The next one coming in July is Heart of Barkness, and it has many scenes down in a town
Peter.
Based on Sassabee, Arizona. So I just, and the desert just seen through a dog's eyes too, just comes to life for me. It's really grabbed me. Anyway, I'm going to start with The Journals of Lewis and Clark.
Mm, of course, they immediately come to mind.
Yeah, this is an edited, these are edited down. So Lewis and Clark, okay, they were both very intelligent men, and their journals are really interesting. Lewis was probably the more introspective of the two, and this journey of theirs is so, one of the great things is they were so well organized. This journey, many journeys going west, we'll get to that later, you know, ended in disaster, but theirs was so smooth. Only one person died, and it was really of disease. On the whole trip, they got along very well with the Native Americans, partly because they had Sacagawea with them, the Indian woman. And it wasn't so much her guiding skills. It was just the fact that she was there. A raiding party, a war party among the Indians would never include a woman. So when they met up with Native Americans and it was seen that there was a woman there, they knew that they came in peace. Anyway, here's a very short excerpt from that gives you a sense of what Captain Lewis was, Meriwether Lewis was like. You know, he was a friend. He and Thomas Jefferson, their families were friends. That's the reason he got this gig. But he was tremendously well trained for it. And Clark was a geographer. They were scientific oriented men. So on August 18th, 1805, they crossed the Great Divide. They're crossing the Great Divide. And Lewis writes this. This day I completed my 31st year and conceived that I had in all human probability now existed about half the period which I am to remain in this sublunary world. I reflected that I have as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence and now sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended. But since they are past and cannot be recalled, I dash from me the gloomy thought and resolve in future to redouble my exertions and at least endeavor to promote those two primary objects of human existence by giving them the aid of that portion of talents which nature and fortune have bestowed on me, or in future to live for mankind as I have heretofore lived for myself. And it tells you about the man. It kind of also tells you about the expedition, which was, Jefferson had to be very clever about it because the Spanish did not want this expedition to happen. So it was really, the Spanish were absolutely right about what their expedition really was. It was about Western expansion of the United States, but it was disguised as a geography trip to map the headwaters of the Missouri River.
Yeah, and listening to that, you hear nuggets too of what are really kind of embedded in our, I don't know, the fabric of being Americans, which is this need to go out and explore. And it's what it sounded like, it was a part of his personality, but it has this kind of larger mission, not just to map, as you just said. And I want to give the number too, because we want to hear what kinds of books come to mind for you, because I'm sure there are a lot of people whose minds are just full of all the different kinds of imagery and just the things that are tied to the American West. 866-999-4626. Or you can email us if you've got a book idea, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And if we get going and we're listing books, don't worry, we'll put them all online later today so you don't have to be running around looking for your notebook. We'll have them all there for you so you can look them up later on.
Can I just jump in with one more just after I've done Jefferson?
Sure, yes.
Because we're going to need extra time. This is where we have to have voice compression. Where
it's so, you know, true. And it's a pledge drive, so we even have less time.
Well, this book is a very important book, I think, in American literature, and that is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown. And so when this book came out, it was really revolutionary. And Dee Brown, what he said about this book is, he said, Americans who have always looked westward when reading about this period should read this book facing eastward.
Mm.
So it's almost the opposite of Lewis and Clark and many of the other books.
Yeah.
And so it's Dee Brown himself was not Indian. But he got interested in Indians when he was very young, and he went to the movies. I think it was a silent movie, and an Indian man in the audience turned to him and said, those Indians and the cowboys and Indians on the screen are not the real Indians. And he got very interested at that moment. Now, the fact of the matter is, when we get to John Ford later, in those old two real or silence, those Indians were real Indians.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. Anyway, this is a heartbreaking book.
Yeah, the darker, there's a very much a darker side that you have to consider when you think about the American West. It's not all kind of gilded and visionary.
Oh, absolutely. So I'll read just a very, so when Philip Sheridan was pacified, this is, you know, Philip Sheridan, the famous Civil War general, hero of the Shenandoah Valley. But after the Civil War, he had another career in sort of pacifying the Native American tribes in the West. So here's this meeting where he was trying to force them all back onto the reservations. And Yellow Bear of the Arapahoes also agreed to bring his, a few days later, Tosawi, who was this chief, brought in the first band of the Comanches to surrender. When he was presented to Sheridan, Tosawi's eyes brightened. He spoke his own name and added two words of broken English. Tosawi, good Indian, he said. It was then that General Sheridan uttered the immortal words, the only good Indians I ever saw were dead. And this became, you know, the only good Indian is just a terror. This, in this story, this chief is trying to be accommodating, and then this is said to him. Now, these things are always so complex. Sheridan denied that he ever said this, and it's still disputed. But even though it may not even be factual, there's a kind of truth to it. Anyway, I couldn't recommend this book more highly. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Mm-hmm. A hugely important piece of history that, you know, we totally worth exploring and helping us to understand, even now, because there's some, I'm sure, relevant stories and anecdotes as part of that book that probably have some resonance even today.
Oh, yes. I mean, that hasn't, this expansion, you know, if you have, it's almost like physics, you know, if you have expansion going on, then somewhere you've got to have contraction. And so the Native Americans contracted.
Yeah. Jill, what do you want to talk about
well,
next?
I want to say, just as an aside, I believe Dee Brown was actually a librarian.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
As its profession.
Oh, wow.
And I buried the lead.
Well, this is my segue to my next book, because one of the reasons I was so excited that we were doing this was because one of my favorite books from this year is, in fact, all about the Los Angeles Public Library. It is a fabulous book called The Library Book by Susan Orlean. It is not just because I'm a librarian that I love this book, but there are a lot of things that a librarian can love about this book. And what's interesting to me is how she frames this. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She doubles as an investigative reporter and an institutional historian. And it's this, the book is framed as the account of the 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Central Public Library. On April 29th, 1986, just before 11 a.m., a fire broke out in the stacks of the main branch and burned for 7 hours, destroying 400,000 books and damaging hundreds of thousands more. Harry Peek, the man police believe started the fire, was arrested but never charged. And Orlean is investigating this fire and why would he, a lot of it is about Peek. He was a struggling actor and a frequent patron of the library, whether he was the guy. But for me, this book was not about Harry Peek. This book is about library history because she goes back and tells the story of librarians in the past at the Los Angeles Public Library. And it is a fascinating and amazing story. And it talks also a lot about the profession of librarianship in that it turned out that men, for some time, were the ones that were the directors of libraries. But however, at the Los Angeles Public Library, they had a woman named Mary Jones. In June 1905, she was told that she was no longer going to be the director because this fellow named Charles Loomis was going to be taking over. And Loomis is one of the most interesting characters in the book. He is a guy that really comes across from the East Coast, but he goes, walks most of the way, actually, to get to Los Angeles. They give him the job. He was born in Lynn, Massachusetts in 1859, but he becomes the librarian, and he is an unbelievable character. And he is being put up against a woman who had been running the library. She decides she's not going to resign. She stays while he's there. And the whole thing sort of gets messy. She decides she's not going to leave. And it, when it was announced in 1905 in the Los Angeles Times, the editorial board argued he was unfit for the job because he had never set foot in a library school, wore eccentric corduroy suits, and was known to drink and swear on occasion. And the story of Loomis is fascinating. And I urge you to read it, not just for the fire, but for all the library history that's in here as well. And he was a character in and of his own, but you also learn a lot about the current staff at the Los Angeles Public Library and all of the ways that librarians have to interact with the public. It's a really fascinating story and lots of stuff that happens behind the scenes at the Los Angeles Public Library. It's called The Library Book, and it is by Susan Orlean.
And, of course, she's a beautiful writer as well, so I'm sure it's just a fun read that way as well.
It absolutely is.
866-999-4626. You can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What book with a Western theme would you add to our list? We have to go to a break, but we'll be right back to talk more books about the American West. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. Today we're talking about books about the American West. And if you've got an idea or suggestion, give us a call, 866-999-4626. Or you can give us shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I'm here with author Peter Abrahams and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. All right, what are we going to talk about next?
Well, next, okay, almost every time I get a chance to somehow work in Huckleberry Finn, I do. And this fits the criterion because it begins in what he calls St. Petersburg, Missouri, but in fact is based on Hannibal, Missouri, and that's on the west bank of the Mississippi River. So it's west.
To your rule.
And, yeah, so it fits the rule. But what is so Western about this is Huck's need to escape civilization. And that motive of the wide open spaces, moving toward a place where there was less law, that was very, in the eyes of many people, that was one of the attractions. So Huckleberry Finn, one of my favorite books anyway. And, you know, the story of this, this is just a little sample of the civilization he needs to get away from. He was living at this point with the widow Douglas and her sister, Miss Watson, who were trying to civilize him. "Well, I got a good going over in the morning from old Miss Watson on account of my clothes, but the widow, she didn't scold. She only cleaned off the grease and clay and looked so sorry that I thought I would behave a while if I could. Then Miss Watson, she took me in the closet and prayed, but nothing come of it. She told me to pray every day, and whatever I asked for, I would get. But it weren't so. I tried it. Once I got a fish line, but no hooks. It weren't any good to me without hooks. I tried for the hooks 3 or 4 times, but somehow I couldn't make it work. By and by, one day, I asked Miss Watson to try for me, but she said I was a fool. She never told me why, and I couldn't make it out. No way." The spirit of the West, I think, lived in the heart of Huckleberry Finn.
Well, it's hard to go from this to from Huckleberry Finn to this, but the book that I've brought with me is When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice by Terry Tempest Williams. It is such a beautiful book. One of the reviews said of it, "Raised Mormon and half in love with the land she lives on, Williams' book almost smells like Utah. The dry air and bright sunshine are palpable. Wilderness in the text is a metaphor for both the land she loves and her very voice as a woman. Both are untamable. Both are creative. Both are threatened." And what's astonishing about this book, first of all, it's physically a beautiful book. The end papers have these gorgeous illustrations of feathers on them. One of the things it does is actually also acts as a flip book. She talks a lot about birds in this book, given that it's called When Women Were Birds. And as a flip book, you can see that you actually get to see, if you flip the pages,
wow,
you get to see the little bird at the edge of the pages
flying. It's flapping its wings.
That's right. But this starts in this sort of heartbreaking way. The first sentence is, I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. And what her mother does is leaves her her journal. She's always known that her mother was writing journals. And her mother tells her before she dies, I am leaving you all my journals, she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back. But you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I am gone. And so the author decides not to look at them till after, but about a year after her mother dies, she decides to look at these journals. She opens them up. She decides it was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where she said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third. It, too, was empty, as was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank. So it goes from that, and then you have blank pages sort of symbolizing the book that was not written. And then this is sort of meditations on her life and her mother's life and Mormon culture and something called the Green Belt Movement, where in Utah, which was trying to stop deforestation. And it is a beautiful meditation on nature and religion and love, and particularly on her mother, and is an astonishing read and something that you can read sort of over and over and in little bits, because it's a great book. If you just want to read one little bit at a time, you can do that. And I highly recommend When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice by Terry Tempest Williams, who I had never heard of before this book, but has written lots and lots of other books about the West. And I hope to look at more of them soon. It's a really lovely thing.
Isn't that fun when you discover an author and then you just discover a trove, a treasure trove?
It is a great, yes, it is a wonderful thing.
Alps on Alps arise, to quote, I think, Pope. Anyway.
Well, I want to hold on 1 minute. I know we have so many books, but we do have a call, and that's Jackie from Orleans has a suggestion. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of old classics I'd like to recommend to people here. I lived in the West quite a while in Nebraska. That they don't consider it West, but we do here. And, so I particularly liked Old Jewels by Marie Sandoz. It's a true story. He's a Dickens of a man, but it's very interesting about the opening of the West. And also Willa Cather's O Pioneers. Mm. Some people may have seen that on television fairly recently. They had a movie of it. But those two books about the West, I would certainly recommend. I know you're probably thinking of new books more than the old ones, but I couldn't.
That's great.
Well, yeah, and excellent. Actually, yeah. Willa Cather is fabulous. I actually did bring along her book, The Song of the Lark, which is also about the West, which I love very much. And so I'm very glad. But who was the author of the first book that you mentioned?
Marie Sandoz.
Okay,
I've
not.
Nebraskan,
okay.
And her father, it's mainly Old Jewels is her father.
Well, that's great. Thank you. And it just shows
you're
you, too,
welcome.
As we said at the beginning of the show, you know, we're kind of jumping around. It's such a massive topic. It's historical, but it's also very modern at the same time. So,
yeah.
And you want to have your next suggestion.
My
here.
Next suggestion. Well, we talked about Lewis and Clark as being a very well-organized expedition. So to get the antipode of that, I think we should go to the Donner Party. which was not a well-organized expedition and did not end
well. So you have a theme going on your side.
I've got a little theme going on my side, always. So there are many books written about the Donner Party. The one I like the best is called The Indifferent Stars Above, The Harrowing Saga of a Donner Party Bride by Daniel James Brown. So all this is through the eye. Well, it's through the eyes of this woman, Sarah Graves, who her whole family left Illinois, the bottom lands, where there was a lot of malaria. I didn't realize that. They didn't know it was malaria. They called it an ague or something.
Mm-hmm.
But every summer they got these terrible fevers. So even though the land was very fertile, a lot of them wanted to leave. And so in the 1840s, they did. And And this is her expedition. Some went from St. Joe, Missouri, and some from Independence. And the rule was you leave by May 1st because the snows in the Sierra are going to build by the time you get there in these oxen-pulled carts. Well, they didn't leave till 3 weeks later, and they hooked up with the Donner Party partway through. So there was a bunch of families, about 87 people, of whom about half survived. They got to what was then called Truckee Lake and is now Donner Lake at what's now called Donner Pass. And the snow, it was a very snowy year anyway. And they were stuck there. And then all this horrific, well, for example, Sarah Graves' husband, they were married just before this, actually was partially eaten during some of the bad moments, but she survived. But you know, none of the PTSD that wasn't a thing then, but you can see that many of the survivors had it. So yes. I recommend this book. It's harrowing, of course, and tragic and sad, and there's racism in it too. There's murder, there's theft, but it's an incredibly great adventure story. The Indifferent Stars Above.
Yeah. And as you said, too, I mean, so many trips probably went off. I mean, a lot of us and my generation know the game Oregon Trail, right, where you could so easily fall off the trail or get sick and die if you didn't have enough food. I mean, I imagine that happened to countless people, and some make it through the annals of history and kind of become like...
Well, speaking of the Oregon Trail, so also there were hucksters involved who had land for sale in California, and they... There was something called the Hastings Cutoff, where they wanted them to go not to California, not to Oregon, but to California to divert them so that they would get their money. And this party fell into that, too. They took the Hastings Cutoff south of Great Salt Lake, and it added 150 miles. Had they not had that, they might have made it through.
Jill, what do you got next?
You know, it's hard to follow the Donner Party, I have to say.
And it would be a mistake.
And it would be a mistake. So I'm going off on a completely different direction here. There were a tremendous number of photographers and artists that are associated with the West. And so let's think of some of them for a moment. One of them was George O'Keeffe, who did these incredible paintings. And she was completely and totally inspired by the Southwest. And I have in front of me a very large and heavy book, but it is such a wonderful book. It's Selected Letters of George O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz, My Faraway One. And just as a matter of interest, there also is a Woods Hole reference in this book, which, I feel I should. I had no idea that, in fact, Alfred Stieglitz had spent a weekend in Woods Hole. And you can read all about it in this book. It's in the index with his mistress who was living on Penzance Point. Yeah, it's a great story. It's a great story. But back to George O'Keeffe's paintings and she goes out and she starts sending. Of course, these are all letters. So they're these wonderful letters about what she is seeing in the West. And let me see if I can find here one little bit of it. Here we go. She says, I don't know what it is about this country. It just seems to turn all my insides over. Whether I stand up there on the roof looking at the star and the sharp black line of the mesa against the sunset glow that is almost gone, or drive in the morning light like this morning, and the thing one tries to paint of it is necessarily such a small phase of it. So there are all these sort of lovely ruminations about what she's seeing. The letters themselves are fascinating. Stieglitz, and they sort of break up and get together and break up. So I highly recommend and you can drop into these anywhere. You don't need to sort of read from the beginning to the end. It's Selected Letters of George O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz, My Faraway One. And if you go to the index, you can see everything about Woods Hole.
Very cool. Very cool.
Well, I would like to do My First Summer in the Sierra by John Muir. So John Muir is an extremely important he was actually born in Scotland, but an extremely important conservationist. He was the co-founder of the Sierra Club because he was the person who pushed for Yosemite to be made a national park, which it was. His philosophy, his writing about the West really can't be topped. It still hasn't been by anybody. But in the summer of 1869, he went to Yosemite. He's still a very young man, and he spent two summers there. He built himself a cabin that had a stream running through one corner so that at nights he would just hear, what a lovely way to sleep, by the way. I wonder if the town would give me a permit to do that. And I recommend the book highly, My First Summer in the Sierra by John Muir. And this is this is the type of thing you see in it. This is his first impression when he got to Yosemite. Bathed in such beauty, watching the expressions ever varying on the faces of the mountains, watching the stars, which have here a glory that the lowlander never dreams of, watching the circling seasons, listening to the songs of the waters and the winds, and birds would be endless pleasure. No other places ever so overwhelmingly attracted me as this hospitable, godful wilderness. So, My First Summer in the Sierra, John Muir.
Mm. And I have a book having to do with film. It's River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge and the Technological Wild West by Rebecca Solnit. If you've never read anything by Rebecca Solnit, she's a beautiful writer. And she takes one little thing and runs with it and goes in every direction. As one reviewer said, it is all at once and in no particular order, a brief summation of a man's life, a meditation on time, image, and motion, a history of the American West as a fount of technological innovation and perceptual change, and a beautiful piece of prose. And all of those things are indeed true. Her opening is, in the spring of 1872, a man photographed a horse. And this the resulting photograph does not survive, but from this first encounter of a camera-bearing man with a fast-moving horse sprang a series of increasingly successful experiments that produced thousands of extant images. And she talks about Leland Stanford, who was the railroad. Of course, we haven't even gotten to railroads yet, which is another huge piece of the West. The railroad had utterly transformed its builders, too, into multimillionaires, buyers of estates, commissioners of paintings and photographs, corruptors of politicians, controllers of much of California, managers of one of the most powerful monopolies this country has ever seen. Stanford was the president of their company, the Central Pacific Railroad, and its most visible figure. She goes on to talk about photographing in Silicon Valley. She gets into sort of the modern Silicon Valley stuff. During a period of feverish creativity that commenced in 1872, Edward Muybridge succeeded for the first time in capturing high-speed motion photographically, the crucial breakthrough that made movies possible. And so this is his story, but it is as much the story of California as a whole and technology in California. It's beautiful meditations. It too, oddly enough, has, I don't know what this is about this group of books, it too has, if you sort of scan, push your pages in the right way, you get to see a flip book of one of Muybridge's films. So
we should do all flip books in the next book.
866-999-4626, or you can email us thepoint@capeandislands.org. I'm so enjoying how we really are kind of pinballing around this huge concept that is the American West. And so those of you who are listening, what book with a Western theme would you add to the list? As you can see, it really can go a lot of different ways. We have to go to a break, but we're going to talk more about books about the American West when we come back. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd, and I'm here this morning with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams, and we're talking about books about the American West. And since we have been going all over the place, I want to put a plug in for a book that I loved as a child, which is literally the first thing I thought of when Mindy approached me and said, would you like to talk with you books? And that was Laura Ingalls Wilder and all of her writings. I loved her so much as a child. Of course, as an adult, I've kind of gone back to look at some of her work with maybe a different set of eyes now that I have more access to history and more of an adult perspective. But I certainly loved going out on the prairie and exploring the West with her as a young child.
Yes, and of course, we're all creatures of the time. It's very hard to... there are problems with being judgmental. I mean, you have to be partially, but there has to be some allowance, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I did John Muir and Yosemite. Yeah. So the great thing about the West is you can always find the exact opposite. So what would be the exact opposite of John Muir and Yosemite? Well, it would be Las Vegas, right? So there are a zillion books about Las Vegas. I like this one, The Money and the Power by Sally Denton and Roger Morris. And it's a history of Las Vegas from 1947 to 2000. So everything is in here. Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, the drug running, the money laundering, Frank Sinatra, the Kennedys. It's all here. And just the garishness and what it says. Well, it's summed up in this wonderful little tag by a social critic I'd never heard of named Robert Goodman, but he's quoted it in this book as saying that Las Vegas is all about the pathology of hope.
Oh, wow.
And I love that expression, the pathology of hope. You could use that to look at the Donner Party, just so much of what had happened. And so this is great on not just the history of it, but what attracts it. Almost half of the American population has been to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is an astounding. So
it really is.
This is, and I haven't. Have you? Who have you been
to Bill? Las Vegas? I have.
Yes,
I have.
Okay, so
yeah.
2 out of 3, right here. There you go.
Yep, it has some sort of sparkly draw for so many Americans.
It has sparkly draw.
Well, going from this is blind to the this next book I'd never heard of before. And this is the joy of doing the show, is discovering books like this that I don't know why everyone hasn't read this. It has not been widely distributed, it doesn't appear. It's called Sorrow of the Earth, Buffalo Bill, Sitting Bull, and the Tragedy of Show Business by Eric Vuillard. It was translated from the French, got a tremendous response in France, perhaps because of the way he speaks of the Wild West shows, not as popular here, as far as I can tell. But he writes this heartbreaking story. It's sort of a meditation. It's really essays on how the little known stories, he says, of Sitting Bull and his fellow Native Americans swallowed up by Buffalo Bill's great entertainment machine. Buffalo Bill was the prince of show business. His spectacular Wild West shows were performed to packed houses across the world, holding audiences spellbound with their grand reenactments of tales from the American frontier. For Bill gave the crowd something they'd never seen before, real life Indians. Told with beauty, compassion, and anger, Sorrow of the Earth shows us tragedy turned into a circus act, history into sham, truth into a spectacle. And I have to say, reading this was really just a very sad experience, a lot of it. But here's just a little bit of it. The central idea of the Wild West show lay somewhere else. The aim was to astound the public with an intimation of suffering and death which would never lose its grip on them. They had to be drawn out of themselves like little silver fish in a landing net. They had to be presented with human figures who shriek and collapse in a pool of blood. There had to be consternation and terror, hope and a sort of clarity, an extreme truth cast across the whole of life. Yes, people had to shudder. A spectacle must send a shiver through everything we know. It must catapult us ahead of ourselves. It must strip us of our certainties and sear us. Yes, a spectacle sears us, despite what its detractors say. A spectacle steals from us and lies to us and intoxicates us and gives us the world in every shape and form. And sometimes the stage seems to exist more than the world. It is more present than our own lives, more moving and more persuasive than reality, more terrifying than our nightmares. And he goes on to talk about how the shows were run. And oddly enough, a lot of it sounds like our current political situation, surprisingly, in sort of, you know, trying to be, it's all about showmanship. It is nothing about what matters. And oddly, his last chapter, his last essay is in fact about snow and the fellow in Vermont who made photographs of all of the snowflakes. I'm sorry, Peter, we are back on the East Coast, but this is only because
you just can't help yourself.
I truly. And it is actually also a beautiful essay on snow and how he was obsessed by snow. And he writes, and while Americans become ever more frantic and people rush to all four corners of the continent to grub around in the earth, foul up the cracks in its surface, start banks, show off their legs, and come up against their desires like stone hurdles, Wilson remains quietly in Vermont on his parents' farm looking. This is all he does, and he takes hundreds of photographs of pine cone scales, moss filaments, flower petals, snail shells, lichen. He's interested in dwarf forms and things that are diminutive or stunted. But what amazes him the most, dumbfounds and mesmerizes him, are things that melt or flow or stream or burn or thaw or fade or hide or disappear. And he's making this connection between the sort of the obsession with these snowflakes and the obsession with the Wild West shows. But it is a really beautifully thoughtful essay about those Wild West shows, which, you know, one saw in the movies all the time. They still exist. But he was using real people and real indigenous people in these shows, and it was not always a happy story at all.
And there's a lot of modern relevance you can kind of hear in the description you were talking about how we kind of are drawn to spectacle. I mean, we just talked about that with Las Vegas has its own kind of spectacle to it, right?
Right, exactly. And this is also part of what happens in here is that people start to get their history from these Wild West shows. And so they are actually learning things that are not true about the West through via the, you know, the story is being told. It's all about who tells the story, right? So in this case, it's
the winners tell
the winner story. So Sorrow of the Earth by Eric Foulard, a beautiful book.
Well, this is one of my very favorite books. I love it. It's called Desert Solitaire, A Season in the Wilderness by Edward Abbey. Edward Abbey's an extremely interesting figure. He was an anarchist who spent he wrote that book about the Monkey Wrench Gang. But he spent in 1956 and 1957, he was a park ranger in the Arches in Moab, Utah. And out of that came this book, Desert Solitaire. Now, he's, I guess in terms of, you know, the wilderness, there's the preservationist style and the conservationist style. He was very much a preservationist style. He became a very controversial figure, partly because he was an anarchist, partly because he was totally against all immigration into the United States, legal and illegal, because he said the more people you have, the less wilderness. Every person you add to our population is going to degrade our country, the wilderness. And that was an unpopular position because it's a kind of, there's a logic to it, but I'm not going to go there at the moment, but I will read this brief. He's just wonderful on understanding the West and the desert and the wilderness. Suppose we say that wilderness invokes nostalgia, a justified, not merely sentimental nostalgia for the lost America our fathers knew. The word suggests the past and the unknown, the womb of earth from which we all emerged. It means something lost and something still present, something remote and at the same time intimate, something buried in our blood and nerves, something beyond us and without limit. Romance, but not to be dismissed on that account. The romantic view, while not the whole of truth, is a necessary part of the whole truth. But the love of wilderness is more than a hunger for what is always beyond reach. It is also an expression of loyalty to the earth which bore us and sustains us, the only home we shall ever know, the only paradise we ever need, if only we had the eyes to see. That's the kind of writing he does. He's my favorite writer about the wilderness. Yes, fierce. Exactly.
Yeah. And Jill?
Well, we did promise a picture book, so I've brought one picture book with me. It's When Esther Morris Headed West, Women in Wyoming and the Right to Vote by Connie Nordheim Woolridge, illustrated by Jacqueline Rogers. What I did not know was, in fact, Wyoming was, in fact, the first state to give women the right to vote before anybody else had given them the right to vote. Women's suffrage became an organized movement at a convention held in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848, but each time a state tried to pass a law giving women the right to vote, the attempt failed. Supporters of women's suffrage began to look to the Western Territories, where only a majority vote of the legislature and the governor's signature were required. proposed laws were just barely voted down in Washington, but in the Wyoming territorial legislation succeeded in 1869 to give women the vote. This is a very sweet sort of story about the woman who is behind this, and her name was, as it's the book starts, with, as she's on the stagecoach, which of course, how can we not talk about stagecoaches? Her name was Esther May Hobart McQuigg Slack Morris, and in 1869, she headed out to South Pass City in the Wyoming territory. She was 55 years old. South Pass City was a place that sprouted out of nearly nothing at the mention of the word gold. The space around it was large and wide open. That was a good thing because Mrs. Morris was a large woman with wide open ideas that needed more room than could be had in New York or Illinois, where she'd come from. You see, she thought a woman should be able to vote and hold office the same as a man. So a great story right now, I would say. And as I say, I learned things I did not know about when women got the right to vote.
Yeah, that sounds great for really adults or for obviously
this
for
is
kids.
True.
As well, but
right.
For adults.
When Esther Morris Headed West, Women, Wyoming, and the Right to Vote by Connie Nordheim Woodbridge. Very fun book.
Peter, what have you got next?
Well, the movies have come up a couple times. You've just mentioned stagecoaches as well. So I'm going to do Print the Legend, The Life and Times of John Ford, the Hollywood director John Ford. You know, he directed many movies, The Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, Mr. Roberts. But he also directed some of the greatest Westerns that have ever been filmed. Stagecoach, you mentioned Stagecoach, Fort Apache, My Darling Clementine, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and of course The Searchers, which was his masterpiece. He's a really interesting guy. He came from Maine, and his parents were Irish immigrants who had come over just before he was born. And he came from Maine, but this is so American. At the age of 21, he was out in Hollywood working in the movie business and very soon directing these two reelers. And as I had said before, you know, talking about Dee Brown's book and That's Not a Real Indian, that quote, this was like in 1914, the Old West wasn't quite gone when they began mythology. It was there. So he knew Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp had dinner at John Ford's house, right?
That's amazing.
And there were real Native Americans. I mean, of course they are real, but I mean ones from the Old West who were in his films. And he, although he was a very difficult man and very cruel to some of the actors, he treated the Native Americans very well. So he was the first one, John Ford, to go up to Monument Valley in Utah, which is just this 5 square miles. But if you've seen that in many people's minds, Monument Valley is the West, and it's because he filmed it over and over. It was Navajo land. He befriended them. He paid them well. He gave them things, and he put them in his movies. There were two brothers who were in many, many. They were great writers, and he loved their phases, and they're in many. So this is, I recommend, there's plenty in here that you don't care about, like, you know, who was in each movie and how much they got paid, but how he felt about the West and how he made the pictures tell the story. He didn't believe in dialogue. He believed that the pictures tell the story. He didn't believe in a lot of camera movement, but he believed very much in how he framed the shots and the angles on them and the deep focus. He pioneered all that. And the beauty of the West, the starkness of it, that you see especially in The Searchers with John Wayne, and how he used John Wayne and Henry Fonda. Anyway, very interesting. And so our view of the West is partly learn from the movies.
I was going to say that, and that's something I thought about when I was kind of thinking about topics I kind of hoped we would cover on this show, is that we really are a movie, we're so movie heavy based, and so many of the books that we might think of or concepts that we might think of with the American West have been covered in these movies. So, and you can hear it in some of the writers that you picked earlier trying to describe the visual impact of nature and just the scope of, you know, the largeness out West as well. So
sure, and the movies are set up to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and speaking of movies and John Wayne, if you have not read Joan Didion's essay called John Wayne, A Love Song. You need to do so, Peter, like immediately.
Okay, I have not.
And here's just a little bit of it. I tell you this neither in a spirit of self-revelation nor as an exercise in total recall, but simply to demonstrate that when John Wayne rode through my childhood and perhaps through yours, he determined forever the shape of certain of our dreams. It did not seem possible that such a man could fall ill, could carry within him that most inexplicable and ungovernable of diseases. The rumor struck some obscure anxiety through our very childhoods into question. In John Wayne's world, John Wayne was supposed to give the orders. Let's ride, he said, and saddle up, forward ho, and a man's got to do what he's got to do. Hello there, he said, when he first saw the girl in a construction camp or on a train or just standing around on the front porch waiting for somebody to ride up through the tall grass. When John Wayne spoke, there was no mistaking his intentions. He had a sexual authority so strong that even a child could perceive it, and a world we understood early to be characterized by venality and doubt and paralyzing ambiguities, he suggested another world, one which may or may not have existed ever, but in any case existed no more, a place where a man could move free, could make his own code and live by it, a world in which if a man did what he had to do, he could one day take the girl and go riding through the draw and find himself home free, not in a hospital with something going wrong inside, not in a high bed with the flowers and the drugs and the four smiles, but there at the bend in the bright river, the cottonwood shimmering in the early morning sun. Hello there. It's a beautiful essay, and she actually also has a book about her growing up in California, and her family goes back generations in California, called Where I Was From by Joan Didion, which is also a great meditation on California and growing up in California.
And also another beautiful writer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I would just like to add that in this book, Print the Legend, on John Ford, you learn how John Wayne, how he discovered his famous walk. It was not natural, and it was suggested to him that he had to improve how he walked, and he practiced and practiced to get his walk.
And that's it. We are out of time. This hour goes by so fast, so many books. I hope it's piqued your interest. We will have a link to the books that we talked about today a bit later on our website, so be sure to look out for that. That's capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And author Peter Abrahams, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Mindy Todd. Thank you for joining us for The Point.